Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 487 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about a few Marvel books today, namely X-23 number 2, X-23 number 3, and Daredevil number 1. This is the Daredevil series from Charles Soule. First issue came out in 2016. I'm a big fan of Charles, but I have fallen woefully behind on Daredevil, something like, I don't know, 10 or 15 issues. I can't remember the last issue I read. So rather than try to flip through and figure out where I was like, you know what? It's been so long since I've read the early stuff. Let me just go back and start over with issue 1. And I thought, well, as long as I'm doing that, I might as well talk about them on Marvel Mondays. So expect to get a Daredevil issue or two on each Marvel Monday episode going forward for at least the next few. Until I either get caught up or just don't feel like talking about it, or I hear from you guys that nobody really wants to hear about Daredevil. anyway, so I wanted to talk about X-23 number 3 as well. It just came out this last Wednesday, August 29th. But then I realized I hadn't talked about X-23 number 2, so I figured I would cover that as well. I also read the Hunt for Wolverine Dead Ends one-shot that came out on the 29th, and I'll be talking about that on tomorrow's Hunt for Wolverine Spotlight. Obviously, the Hunt for Wolverine wraps up the whole Hunt for Wolverine storyline that was across four different individual four-issue miniseries draws to a close with this one-shot, so we won't be doing Hunt for Wolverine Spotlights anymore on Tuesdays, but we are going to talk about The Return of Wolverine, which is a five-issue miniseries from Charles Soule and Steve McNiven. But because the Hunt for Wolverine storyline was four issues, four separate miniseries, we basically had one to talk about each week. But being that The Return of Wolverine is a monthly series, we only have one. So obviously there's going to be some other Tuesdays without a Return for Wolverine episode. So I thought what I would do on those Tuesdays is talk about the extermination event, still keeping with the X-Men mutant theme on Tuesdays. We had, I think, two issues of Extermination come out so far, but then I think the last three issues of the Extermination event are also monthly. So we'll be able to do, I think, the first three, and then there'll be a big gap before we get to talk about 4 and 5. But don't worry, I will fill in whatever gaps there are with other current X-Men mutant stuff that's coming out to make sure that we keep going with our Tuesday theme of talking about the X-Men and what's going on currently. Speaking of the X-Men, because we don't put out enough episodes for all you listeners, we're also going to start doing a X-Men chronology. So that'll be coming out on Fridays. And I'm not just going to go back to X-Men number 1 from Kirby and Stan Lee and move forward chronologically with as they were published. What I want to do is I want to read them in a chronological order that makes sense. So that means that the very first issues I might read might be something like Apocalypse's origin, right? Because that takes place the furthest back in time in ancient Egypt. I'll be reading things like X-Men First Class and X-Men, I think there was another one, the early years, I think it was called. So those things will be interspersed when necessary to, again, give this like complete storyline from as far back in the past as X-Men stories go, reading on up into the future. And I realize this is something that's probably going to take years to do, but we'll go ahead and kick it off and we'll get it started and we'll see how far we get. Kind of similar to the Secret War or the Marvel chronology with the Secret Wars that we're doing, or the Top Cow chronology. It's just a way to go back and read some of these books I've never read before, and also gives you listeners a chance, maybe who've never read the X-Men stuff or want to learn more about the X-Men to get a chance to check all that out. So before we kick that off, I'm hoping to do an episode that's a little more broad that talks about the X-Men as a concept, you know, their origins and any kind of influence or ties they have to like the civil rights movement. That's been talked about and speculated a lot what Stan Lee necessarily had in mind with the X-Men. And he's said some contradictory things over the years. But I definitely want to touch on that and just touch on how popular and how well the X-Men movies have done and you know, the cartoon and how they really were kind of foisted on the greater consciousness of pop culture kind of in the 90s. I think with the cartoon was really a lot of people's first exposure to the X-Men. So it's such a big corner and a big part of the Marvel universe. I'm trying to read a lot more Marvel these days, and I really do want to get caught up with everything that's gone on in the X-Men corner of the universe over the years. So I thought this would be a good way to do it. So hopefully you guys enjoy it. So look forward to that coming up on Fridays soon. I also want to give everybody a chance to suggest things for Marvel Mondays. If there's a Marvel book that you think that I should read or talk about that you've really enjoyed, or something you've always been curious about but never had the chance to read and you're curious about my opinion on it and you want me to talk about it on Marvel Mondays, hit me up on Twitter or send me an email or Facebook or whatever, and let me know what book it is. And if you've read it, let me know what you thought of it and why I should check it out. And I'll definitely cover it on an upcoming episode of Marvel Monday. So let's go ahead and dive into X-23 number 2. It's written by Mariko Tamaki. We've got art by Juan Cabal, colors by Nolan Woodard, and letters by Corey Petit, with a cover by Mike Choi and Jesus Abertov. And inside the front cover, we have the kind of the synopsis. Clone from Wolverine, Laura Kinney began her life as a weapon called X-23. After she escaped those who created her, she located another clone, Gabby. Together, the sisters began to fight for a better future. But to move forward, you have to face what's behind you, which is hard to do when your life began in a lab. Laura's been tracking genetic scientists working on projects similar to the one that created her. One of these scientists, Dr. Helen Marks, has gone missing. What Laura doesn't know, though, is that the Stepford Cuckoos, a powerful psychic quintet turned trio, has kidnapped Dr. Marks and used her to reanimate their two dead sisters. So we actually saw that at the end of the first issue of X-23, how the Stepford Cuckoos, who I don't know a whole lot about, I've read up on them a little bit. If I remember correctly, they're clones of the White Queen. So they have telepathic powers, mental powers, and one was killed and they became a quartet, and then another was killed and they became a trio. And I personally don't really care for them as characters. I just think it's kind of lame, you know, far too many clones running around and, you know, they speak in unison and they, you know, they look pretty bleached out with, you know, the White Queen look with the hair and everything. And I just don't find them that interesting. Now, granted, I haven't read a whole lot of them, but just as a concept, I don't care for it that much. They go to Xavier's school. They seem to be pretty powerful. And you would think that they would have learned something going to Xavier's school about responsibility and consequences in life or whatever. But apparently they're maybe cloned too well from the White Queen, and really they're quite selfish and only care about themselves and have managed to resurrect their two dead sisters. But we saw at the end of issue one of the resurrected sisters kill the other in an effort to prolong her life. Because again, selfish. And what we did see was, even though they're resurrected, they're clearly not healthy. They're not whole. They seem deformed and they seem to be having some trouble. And we're not exactly sure what's going on there. So that's kind of what we saw last issue. And clearly no one at the school realizes that these Stepford Cuckoos are undergoing or have undertaken this pretty creepy and disgusting plan. And they are actually behind the disappearance of Dr. Helen Marks. So as this issue opens up, we have a scene looking up from a grave. And the narrator says that funerals are strange things when you're a mutant or a clone or both, probably because they don't die very often. Or at least when we do, it's much more complex than a normal person, and people who die under complex circumstances don't generally get funerals. There are better ways to die if you're a mutant or a clone, and the best thing to do is to die a hero. And we learn this is the grave of Sophie Cuckoo, according to the grave marker there, the headstone. And we see the other four cuckoos walk away, and they seem to be very sad. And then as we turn the page, we see the three remaining fully healthy cuckoos have all been sharing this dream. And they come out into the common area where they live, speaking in unison as they often do, saying something's wrong. And they leave the school, get into a cab, and one tells the other to, I told you I felt something when we went to bed. And they head to the church where they had the two sisters who aren't fully healthy that they've resurrected. And the narration continues saying, worse, you're a casualty of someone else's plot. That happens a lot when you're not human. And we see the one sister's desiccated body laying there in bed. The sister who drained her, obviously not letting the other cuckoos know that, looking healthier than the dead body, but not by much. And the other three sisters in tears. So as we turn the page, we see Laura Kinney in bed and learn that she's the one that's been narrating the story so far. And she goes on to say she doesn't spend much time thinking about it. Death is what she means. She says, we are what we are, meaning mutants, and they are what they are, meaning humans. And then she thinks, do mutants dream of mutant sheep? Who cares, right? It's not something she concerns herself with. And then she's awakened by Gabby jumping into her bed, yelling for pancakes. And Laura's response is, one day you're going to wake me up like that and get a blade in the forehead. But Gabby says, I'm not worried. I got the super healing, so I'd still be good for pancakes. So as Laura fixes her breakfast and Gabby chows down on pancakes, Gabby's continuing to bug Laura as she did last issue about a birthday. And she thinks that they should pick a birthday to have a giant party. And Laura says, just because the cuckoos did that doesn't mean that we should do that. In fact, that might actually be a reason not to do it. The cuckoos are weird. And Laura wants to know why Gabby's so suddenly obsessed with having a birthday. And Gabby says, well, it sounds fun. And she's like, is there a reason you won't tell me your birthday? And Laura says, well, because it's not my birthday. It's just a day like any other, especially when you come out of a test tube. You know, it's not really a birthday. But Gabby's not dissuaded. She's like, come on, just tell me when the day is. And Laura says, you know, we're going in circles. I'm going to follow up on this thing Hank told me about. We saw last issue, Hank told Laura about the missing scientist and gave her some clues to the whereabouts. And she tells Gabby, stay here, practice your nunchucks. I'll be back. Then the scene shifts to the Xavier School. We see the three cuckoos have returned. They talk about going in circles. They talk about how something feels wrong. But ultimately, this is the plan, and they all decided on it. And they have to keep moving forward. But they do acknowledge that if they do this, if they continue to follow their plan, they're never coming back to the Xavier School. But ultimately, they say, we must do this. We are the four in one now. Nothing is more important than that. The plan is set. There's no turning back. It's just a building. Never anything more. We lose nothing and we gain our sisters. That's all that matters. But we do see one of the cuckoos, Mindy, look back. And perhaps they're not all in sync as much as you would think, or as much as the other two seem to believe. Meanwhile, the narration from Laura continues with her saying home is obviously not the same thing when you're created in a test tube, but she's returning to the Gene Genie laboratory where she was created, and goes on to say, you know, you want to say the smells that remind you of your world when you're younger remind you of home, but they don't, because it never was your home. It was a lab and you had a cell and no choices. But it's complicated. So she does show up at the laboratory. She's welcomed with open arms, and she asks to see Dr. Marks's office, even though her laptop is encrypted. She does come across a exercise band, like a Fitbit kind of device, and manages to track the doctor through that. and ends up standing in front of the aforementioned church saying, right, so you just ran off to a nice old abandoned church at the edge of the city. Hooray. And Laura thinks that, you know, as a superhero, you don't really spend a lot of time in churches generally. But when she walks in, she can tell right away that something's not right. Dr. Marks is definitely there, but there's something else, the smell of death. And as she's looking around, she hears a board creak behind her, turns around and sees Gabby and asks, what are you doing here? And Gabby's response is, you texted me. Cool church. What's up? Laura says, I didn't text you. And we get a voice from off panel that's actually three voices saying, thank you for coming. And we see the Stepford Cuckoos saying, we could say something about having no choice, but they acknowledge that they all make choices and their choices are predicated on protecting the four as no one else will. And Laura says, whatever you have planned, and the Cuckoos activate their powers saying the plan is already in motion. And Gabby then sees about 100 Stepford Cuckoos. Death is suddenly everywhere around them, but Laura is not afraid. She says, you know, I fought death before. Let's do this. But then she senses that something's wrong. She knows that she's already said that. Who is she actually fighting? Is she fighting the Cuckoos? Is she fighting herself? And she eventually falls to the floor and manages to concentrate enough to shut out the visions. And when she comes to, she's calling after Gabby. But when she looks around, the church is empty. Gabby is in the back of a van being driven away, and we get the to-be-continued message. And that leads right into issue 3 with the same creative team. So Mariko Tamaki writing. We have Juan Cabal on pencils and inks. We have colors by Nolan Woodard and letters by Corey Petit. So once again, we have Laura Kinney, X-23, narrating. She gets this feeling when someone she knows dies. It's not like getting injured, which she barely notices anymore. It's like an itch. There's something in her DNA that says, remember this. Maybe it's fear, the fear you get when knowing nothing else can hurt you. Fear for the fearless, basically. Like, what does Laura fear, right? She doesn't fear getting hurt because, as she said, she hardly notices it anymore. She has the healing factor. But the fear comes in not for fear of her own safety, but fear for those around her, fear for losing someone like Gabby, you know, who she considers a sister. So she goes chasing after the van. You know, she heard the tire squeal as it left the church, and she spotted it, and she goes chasing after it, leaping from car to car until she's finally able to leap onto the van that she believes holds her sister. And once she stabs the engine block through the hood of the car and it veers off, she goes behind the van, opens it up, and discovers that she's been tricked by the Stepford Cuckoos. There is basically a uniform of Gabby behind there in the back of the van, but the Cuckoos knew that Laura would try to track Gabby by scent, and they've managed to escape. So Laura says no more mistakes. She heads back to the church. She finds Dr. Marks listening to some headphones. She has a conversation with her about what she was doing, and it's clear that Dr. Marks wasn't fully aware of her surroundings, right? She's like, why am I in a church? I thought I was in my lab. And Laura's asking, I need you to tell me what you're here doing with the Cuckoos. And she's like, oh, you're X-23. Like, yes, Dr. Marks, you were continuing your research on the cloning with the Cuckoos. Is that what you were doing here? She's like, you know, working on the project with you really changed my life. And Laura's not, she doesn't have time for it. She said, let's skip the trip down memory lane. I need to know what you've been doing for the past week. And it starts to come back to Dr. Marks. And she said, well, my research moved from cloning to grafting, imposing cloned psyches onto existing life forms. Cloning takes too much time. There's too many variables and X factors. Every clone comes with its own interferences and its own complexities. So the tissue I was given to work with was rapidly disintegrating, and previous attempts to clone seemed to have resulted in compromised forms. So clearly she was given some tissue that belonged to the Stepford Cuckoos. She's talking about how, you know, compromised forms, that's clearly what we saw with the two sisters that were deformed. And Marx goes on to say that she surmised that there was a psychic field that was acting like a virus. The process for it to work, you've got to resist the effects of the psychic energy. And so that required a strong immune system to stabilize it. So it's kind of interesting, right? So they're trying to clone the Stepford Cuckoos, get some two good quality clones to replace the two that died, basically to have two new clones of them. But their inherent mutant ability of constantly being psychically linked was causing the degradation of these cloned bodies. So it's kind of interesting that the powers that they have were ultimately the downfall that kept the cloning from being successful. And clearly the fact that because of this psychic energy causing trouble, even for a grafting process, them needing a strong immune system to stabilize it makes perfect sense why they would kidnap Gabby. Because as we know, she has that strong healing factor that can, you know, fight off just about anything and heal just about any wound. So Dr. Marx goes on to say it's sort of a parasitic approach. Instead of replicating, we're invading. And in my research, I noted that the X-23 would provide an ideal host. And we know that Gabby technically is a clone of Laura. So Gabby would be a perfect candidate for that. And so Laura says, "My sister's," and then asks Marx if she built it. And Marx says, "Build what?" And Laura says, "The machine that lets you graft someone onto an X-23 clone." And Marx is trying to remember. She's, "I think yes, not really sure." And Laura says, "I took an oath to make sure nothing like what my sisters and I went through happens again. I took a name I hate, that name being X-23. So you know your end, the end of this work came at the hands of your creation." And she goes on to say, "I'm going to find my sisters," but warns Dr. Marx, "No more clones. And don't think because this warning doesn't come with a blade to the stomach, it's an empty threat." And at that moment, Gabby's able to activate a tracking device that she had in her headband. And Laura's belt goes off, and she starts heading toward where Gabby's being held. Meantime, Gabby is being placed into a machine to have the consciousness of this, the one Stepford Cuckoo that's been cloned and is in pretty bad shape, to have her consciousness transferred over. Meanwhile, Laura calls for some help to get transportation to where Gabby is. And as Gabby sits there and looks over at this Stepford Cuckoo next to her, she says, "Hey, Cuckoo, you look kind of moldy. Oh, sorry if that moldy thing was rude. So what's going on?" And then we see Laura is being transported by the angel and asks to be dropped many, many feet above the warehouse where the Stepford Cuckoos are holding up. And she basically turns herself into a flying missile as the Stepford Cuckoos are about to activate the machine. And as Laura breaks through the ceiling, one of the Stepford Cuckoos says, "You're too late. The machine has been switched on." And Laura screams, "No!" And we get that "to be continued" message at the bottom of the screen again. So I think based on who the Stepford Cuckoos are and the fact that they're clones of the White Queen and care more about their deceased sisters than living people, it's clear that in my mind, they're villains. They do kind of make good villains. They're extremely unlikable. So I do like the tale that that Mariko Tamaki is crafting here, and it's a good juxtaposition against Laura herself, who is willing to make a lot of sacrifices for others, whereas the Cuckoos are all self-centered. In a way, they're all one person, right? The four in one, is as they currently refer to themselves. So it's all about them. So it's a good, they're really a good foil for Laura, who, as I said, is willing to sacrifice herself for others. So it's a good story, and I like what's going on. It's really the first long X-23 story that I read. Kind of steered away from some of the stories in the past, just because I felt like, being that X-23 is a clone of Wolverine, I always feel like, man, you know, Marvel's beating a dead horse. We have all these different Wolverines running around. I'm just happy to read about Wolverine, right? I don't need to, I'm not trying to encourage Marvel to beat that dead horse. And it's kind of the reason that I stayed away, but I do have to admit that, Laura is very different than Logan. And, you know, with what we learned recently in the Adamantium Agenda, miniseries, that perhaps Laura isn't a clone after all. I think that would help to strengthen her as her own individual character. And she's pretty interesting, has her own kind of motivations. And I find myself enjoying her as a character. I really feel like Mariko Tamaki is putting her in a good spot and really helping to give her an authentic voice, to really make her her own character. Now, again, this is all with the caveat that I haven't read a lot of other X-23 focused books. I mean, I've read, you know, she's been in like the Phoenix Resurrection and Extermination, some of the other books that I've read recently, but I haven't read any of her previous series, but I am enjoying this one so far. All right, so let me move on to the final book I'm going to talk about in this episode. It's Daredevil number one, as I mentioned, the Charles Soule version. This issue is written by Charles Soule. We've got art by Ron Garney and colors by Matt Milla. And the art is something that it's very interesting. I mean, I know Ron Garney's work from mostly from his previous Captain America work, and I feel like that work looked a lot more polished than this. This is a little bit rougher, more of kind of a sketchy style. And with the color work by Matt Milla, which tends to be extremely washed out, extremely faded, it gives it a certain feel of being very visceral. And also, I'm pretty sure all that previous Ron Garney work that I saw, he wasn't inking himself, which he is here. So I'm sure that that adds to kind of the unfinished look. So again, as Charles Soule writing Daredevil, Charles Soule is a lawyer in his own right. So I was very excited for him to be able to take on this character of Daredevil. I had talked to Charles about it before he took over. I know he's very excited and had a lot of ideas for the book. And as I said, this first issue came out in 2016. So he's going on over 2 years now of writing the character. I don't know when his run is going to come to an end. And I have heard some people complaining in the past about it moving kind of slow. I can't really speak to that again, because I haven't read the entire run. But I'm sure I'll get to it, and I'll comment on that as I start getting deeper into the run. So the book opens with Daredevil diving off the Manhattan Bridge after a guy who's been tossed off, and he's got literally has concrete blocks chained to him. And Daredevil remarks that his name is Matt Murdock, and he's not afraid as he dives into the water after this guy. And up at the top of the bridge, we see there's a gang of guys who are commenting that they can't believe that Daredevil just jumped right in after Billy. And one of the other of the gang says, what, you'd rather he stayed up here? And another of the gang asks if they think Daredevil will be able to save Billy. And the response says, no way, we're too high up. They're both dead from the fall. But the leader of this gang, or what appears to be the leader, says, you know, we can't go back to 10 fingers unless we're sure that Billy Lee's dead. You know how he is. You can't lie to him. So we need to be able to say that, yes, Billy's dead, and to put a cherry on top, Daredevil as well. So keep your eyes on the river and make sure. So meanwhile, under the water, Daredevil is trying to locate Billy. He's using his radar sense, but it doesn't work well underwater because sound moves strangely. It moves more than four times as fast as it does through the air. And that has to do with the fact that the water molecules are, you know, and the molecules of a liquid are a lot more dense than the molecules of air, closer together. So Daredevil is basically saying it's hard to process imagery that quickly. Or maybe he's just running out of air. He's not sure. And then he thinks he hears a heartbeat, but he's not sure. And he can't pinpoint it. And so he fires off the grappling hook from his billy club. And it hits mud. And he thinks to himself, man, the bottom of the East River used to be nothing but wrecked cars and old refrigerators. That was a river you could rely on. And I think I even donated to the cleanup of it, never again. And the heartbeat's getting weaker, and so he fires off the grappling hook again, and this time manages to hit a car, and he's basically using that sound as sonar. So as that sound of the grappling hook hitting the car radiates out in the water, it shows him the outline of a body, and he's able to cut Billy loose and bring him to the surface under the river to one of the pilings. And Billy's like, "Oh, you saved me." And Daredevil responds, I told you I would. You're lucky that Ten Fingers guys dropped you where they did, though. If they'd taken you out to the middle of the bridge, neither one of us would have survived the fall." And then he tells Billy to stay there and he'll be back. And Billy's like, "Why would you go back up there? Right now they think we're dead. If you go back up there, they're going to know that we survived. So we could just wait them out down here." And Daredevil says, "Yeah, we could, but then they'd never learn." And he goes up to the top just as the gang is about to leave, saying it's been 10 minutes. They're probably dead. And Daredevil starts to attack them. But what he quickly realizes is, although the guys just look like a bunch of street thugs, they fight like they've been training all their lives with Iron Fist. And then there's the whole fingers thing. And then Daredevil gets shot, gets grazed on the arm. He's like, "Man, I missed. Didn't even realize this guy was about to shoot me. The fall must have scrambled my senses more than I realized." And the gang members asking Daredevil if he really thought that Daredevil could take them all out on his own. And Daredevil says, "Actually, no." And at that moment, the guy with the gun gets basically knocked out. And all of a sudden, it seems there's an invisible force that is attacking the gang. And with that help, the help of a character named Blindspot, Daredevil's able to defeat the thugs. And as Daredevil is kind of cleaning up, he tells them, "You tell Ten Fingers he's done. There's nothing he can do about it. He's just making it worse for himself." And the gangs, the few that aren't knocked out, run off. And Daredevil says, "Thank you very much. That could have been ugly." And Blindspot says, "You're welcome," as he becomes visible again. And Daredevil says, "You know, you fought very well tonight, but can I ask what took you so long? I mean, Chinatown is literally right there." And he points just down the block. And Blindspot's response is, "Yeah, I had to stop and buy batteries. Invisibility doesn't just happen. You know, maybe your powers are free, but mine cost." And Daredevil says, "So did mine, Blindspot, believe me." And then tells Blindspot to meet him at 2 a.m. at the usual training spot. Blindspot isn't real happy about that. He's like, "Come on, man, I thought you said I did well. When do I get to sleep?" And Daredevil's response is, "When you're good enough to beat me." And swings off, and Blindspot says, "All right, boss man." So meanwhile, a little while later, 12:06 a.m., we're in Foggy's apartment. Billy Lee is asleep, and Foggy remarks that he crashed out pretty quickly. And Daredevil's response is, "Well, he had a hell of a night." And Foggy, you can tell by his body language, isn't very happy. He tells Daredevil, "You know, I thought we had an understanding, you and I." Matt says he wouldn't have survived the night. This is the only place I could bring him that where he'd be safe. And Foggy's like, "Well, what about me? When will I be safe?" And Daredevil's response is, "Don't be ridiculous." And Foggy's like, "It's not ridiculous. Just because you let me remember doesn't change what you did to make everyone else forget." And this is in reference to the previous series, the Mark Waid and Chris Somni series, where the world at large knew Daredevil's secret identity. Now apparently it is secret again, and we don't know how or why that happened, but I'm sure that we will find out shortly. But however it happened, Foggy still remembers that Daredevil and Matt Murdock are one and the same. He doesn't necessarily seem to be very happy about it either. And Foggy's like, "He is asleep, right?" Foggy wants to be sure that Billy Lee is not spying on them, basically. And Daredevil's like, "Yeah, he's out, definitely." And Foggy says, "Good. You know, I didn't ask to be the only person left who knows Daredevil's real name. I don't want to be your conscience or your safe harbor." And Daredevil responds that he had to do what he did. Foggy, Matt Murdock, and Daredevil were becoming each other's worst enemies. But now Matt Murdock can live his life, and Daredevil can take risks again. And everything he had to do was worth it. So it sounds like he would do it again if necessary. And Foggy's not convinced, and he's also worried about Blindspot, the kid that Daredevil's working with. How can he be so trusting? And Daredevil says, "Because I trust him and I need him and I have this feeling, and Blindspot's the one thing he's sure is right." But Foggy's had enough, and he says, "This is the last time I will help you. Never again, Matt." And Daredevil swings off. So the next day, we see Matt in his office at the district attorney's office. So this is a new change in the Charles Soule run as well. You know, previously, Matt Murdock had always been a defense attorney. Now he's working for the district attorney. And what's interesting is he's in an elevator shaft. That's his office. And one of his colleagues shows up and says that one of his grand jury witnesses is there to see him and remarks on having an office in the elevator shaft. And Matt's reply is, you know, I don't mind. This place is packed. Every office is full. And as the newest assistant district attorney, it's to be expected. And why should they waste a room with a view on a blind guy? So it's kind of funny. And I asked Charles Soule about this, and he actually got this from someone he spoke to in the New York district attorney's office that said that they actually knew someone whose office was at the bottom of an elevator shaft. So he thought he would throw that in there. He thought that was pretty interesting. So it turns out that the witness to that wants to speak, the witness to the grand jury that wants to speak with Matt Murdock, is Billy Lee, the very same that got rescued the night before. And he talks about not wanting to be sure to testify and being really scared. And Matt's response is, you know what? I'm not sure I care. This is how it works. You're a bad guy. We have evidence that can put you away for a long time. But what we'd rather have is you testify against Ten Fingers so we can get a bigger fish. But if that's not what you want to do, then, you know, we're happy to have all the charges against you come crashing down on your head. So going to Rikers, I'm sure there's plenty of folks that would love to have a chat with Big Mouth Billy Lee. You have zero good options, but, you know, if you stick with us, I can make sure that you stay safe, just like you were safe last night after you fell off a bridge. And Billy Lee response is, you didn't do that, Daredevil did. And Matt says, yeah, because I asked him to, but I can also I asked him to protect you, but I can also ask him to stop. So Billy's definitely in between a rock and a hard place. But Matt does try to reassure him by saying, you know, I know you're afraid. It's something I know about being blind. I never know when something's coming at me that I can't see, but I can't let that stop me. Otherwise, I'd never leave the house. What am I just going to sit around and wait to die? That's no life. So I think about what I have to gain by going out there and facing my fears and everything I have to lose. And I have to decide for myself that I'm not afraid. Then the scene shifts to Chinatown. We see the leader of the gang reporting to Ten Fingers that Daredevil and Billy Lee escaped with the help of Blindspot. And Billy Lee is still among the living. And it appears that Ten Fingers is really not very happy about that. So as a punishment to the gang leader, they're going to take off his whole hand. Previously, Ten Fingers said he was prepared to take only two fingers from him if he'd succeeded. He asked for another chance, but unfortunately, that's not how it works. And another one of the gang asked what they should do about Big Mouth Billy. And Ten Fingers says that it was something he hoped to avoid, having it be so public. But go ahead and kill Billy right in the courthouse if necessary. And while you're at it, kill the lawyer too. And behind, we hear the response, "You got it, boss man. You can count on me." And the person responding is Blindspot. So perhaps Daredevil's faith in Blindspot is misplaced. I don't know. It's yet to be determined. But we do see Ten Fingers, who appears to be quite creepy, as he literally has 10 fingers on each hand. And it's to be continued in the second issue, which I will talk about on next Marvel Monday. So that's going to do it for this episode. Hope you guys all enjoyed hearing about the latest two issues of X-23, as well as Charles Soule's first issue of Daredevil. As always, I want to thank you all for listening. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our ability to reach listeners, as well as our visibility on all those platforms, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes, which help our podcast show up a lot higher on the list when anyone does a search for a comic book podcast. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.